Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Clubs in Forum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum, and you can follow the best of our speaker dialogue on Twitter from our handle at InforumSF. I am Micah Fitzerman-Blue, co-founder of Bureau of Trade, and tonight I am joined by Joel Stein. Joel Stein is a friend, a socialite, a man, first and foremost. He is also a regular contributor for Time magazine, and his latest book, his first book, has just come out. It is called Man-Made, A Stupid Quest for Masculinity, which the Walter Isaacson, described as a Father's Day love letter disguised as a set of adventure tales. Please welcome Joel Stein.
It's kind of serious.
This is like, can we sit? Should we stand?
I think we should sit.
Okay. They look like San Francisco and South Bay.
They do.
Yeah.
They do. They're a good-looking crowd.
They're good-looking, but it looks like they want to just do good in the world. And they're confident that they are doing good in the world.
So, Joel.
I fear them.
We're here to talk about manhood and masculinity in this hour. And because of that, I want to begin with a backtracking caveat. I want to establish some goodwill and a common understanding between the two of us and this crowd tonight to acknowledge what I think is a very important point to acknowledge. The writer John Scalzi recently wrote about the difficulty of explaining to white men exactly how easy and privileged their lives are.
It's pretty good.
And he settled on a metaphor that I love, which is that being a white man is like playing a video game called Real Life on the lowest possible difficulty setting there is. And before we complain about how difficult and confused and problematic it is to be a man today, in general, much less a man who is also manly, I want us to acknowledge that, yes, life is hard, but it's also really easy for white men.
This seems like a great San Francisco opening statement.
Yes.
When I got to Stanford in 1989, I had not heard a statement like that before in my life. And as part of the first few days when we had speakers and they taught us what to do at school, a Latino woman gave us a speech about how awful white men were. And all of us were just freaked out. But now I'm totally used to it. So, yeah, it is easy. It is awesome. Our problems can best be understood by, like, Ordinary People or Judd Apatow movies or Modern Family. They are funny, funny problems we have.
Well, so then why write this book easy to be a man?
Well, our problems are funnier than other races' problems, other genders' problems. I know other genders try really hard. They sometimes succeed to be funny, but our problems are inherently more amusing.
And
the stakes are so low.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I'm married. I have a kid. I have a good job. If I'm not manly enough, oh well. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is my own little inner turmoil that amuses others and myself.
Okay. So you sit down. You're Joel Stein. You can write any book you want. Why this one? Are we in a crisis of masculinity right now? Do we have a poor lot? Has something changed in society that this new argument needs to be brought forth?
I was just reading the Clint Eastwood interview in Esquire, and he referred to our generation as the pussy generation. And I will say that he is an outlier, even in his own generation, in masculinity. But it's my belief that if you look at the long reach of history, each generation is successively less masculine. That, you know, I think about Don Draper from Mad Men being so manly, but then they would show clips of his dad during the Depression. Like, I don't know if he was a farmer or a miner, but that guy would just come home and look sour and beat people. Like, that, just drink bad rot gut and beat people. Then if you go back far enough, if you trust the Bible at all, men's lives used to be spent going to the town next to theirs, killing as many people as they can, raping as many women as they can, and taking everyone else as slaves.
Yep.
So I assume my son's life will be much less madly than even my own.
But is that progress? Is that a form of progress?
It is. It's a great form of progress. And thank God. And I think it's all great, and I don't wish for anything else. I just think, as with all progress, with the, say, 90% of good you get, you lose 10% of good. And my attempt was to try and keep the good parts that we had lost without saying we should go back to, I don't want to, I've talked to John Hamm about this, and he's like, I wouldn't want to live back then. Like, you didn't have a real relationship with your wife, and you were totally repressed, and you never smiled, and you were afraid to let people know what you thought in the office. No, I'm not advocating this isn't a reactionary book. This is just saying, hey, we got rid of so much bad stuff, but some of that stuff is worth keeping.
What is the thing that is most worth keeping about manhood?
I think there's a certain sense of self-reliance that's also confidence.
Yeah.
Like, I now fix stuff in my house occasionally. Do I have to? No, I'm lucky enough as a white man where I don't have to. White men are confusing. If we say white men, we mean white men in the North, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. Just want to establish what we mean. So, but now that I fixed up in my house, first of all, it's faster, it's cheaper, and it makes me feel differently about my house. It makes me much more connected to just everywhere to my house, to my neighborhood, and it gets me laid with my wife. So all in all, I recommend that people get a little more self-reliant. And the more of this stuff I did, the more I learned that there's a certain fear of confrontation I have. That in the end, I thought might be just a fear of getting punched in the face.
Yeah.
So for the book, I got punched in the face and fought.
Yeah, I want to talk about getting punched in the face.
Yeah. Have you ever been punched in the face?
I have been punched. I've been slapped in the face. And I once,
in like a duel? Or what kind of situation is this?
By a man who is sort of just like me, equally effete and kind of on the border.
You had
and
a
he
slap
didn't
fight?
He didn't know what to do. And he was so mad at me. And I saw his hand ball into a fist.
Right.
But when it struck my face, it had sprung
back.
Open. So I got the full five fingers. I didn't get the knuckles.
No, after
I couldn't have taken it.
After a man slaps you in the face, is he at all embarrassed, or what? Does he feel like he did some damage? Like, how does he feel?
We looked at each other
and made out.
And we just knew we had both failed entirely in that situation. Like, life had dished up like one of the rare physical
right.
altercations I will ever be in, and it didn't work out.
You just walk away.
Didn't work out. But I want to talk about you fighting, because in the book you describe stepping into the ring with Randy Couture. Who is he and why?
There was a point in the book where I was at the Lake Austin Spa and Resort with my 60-year-old mother, and drinking some kind of iced green tea barley beverage. Working out in the gym on an elliptical machine, watching Ellen, and then I flipped channels, and I came across a UFC fight.
Yeah.
Actually, it wasn't even a UFC fight. It was like there's like local Florida UFC, which is just guys in a backyard in a cage. And I switched right away. And then I realized, like, there's a little flash in my brain, like, this is why I'm afraid of confronting anyone in life. I need to get in a fight. And then I thought, how do I get in a fight? And I don't know if you walk into a bar and insult someone's woman, or I had no idea how to get in a fight. So I do what wimpy journalists do when they want to do something, which is I call the publicist. So I called the publicist for the UFC, and I said, you know, I'm writing this book. I would love to get in the ring for one round with one of your fighters, knowing that they would say no because they have lawyers and this was never going to happen. And the publicist said, that's a great idea. And I think it would be great if you fought Randy Couture. At which point I Googled Randy Couture, and I realized this was not a great idea.
Describe him.
Randy Couture, he's in The Expendables. He does some acting, too. He looks like a very mean man. He's a big guy with a shaved head and, like, these lines. I don't know how you get them in your forehead. He looks like stone.
Punching.
He looks like he's been carved in every way. And there's no pictures of him smiling on the Internet at all.
Okay.
I don't know how that happens. He must have smiled somewhere, sometime.
So Randy Couture has agreed to fight you.
Yes.
In some polygon.
Octagon.
The octagon.
Yeah.
And you just stepped into the ring with him sort of cold, or did you prep?
I did some training with Dana White, who is the president of the UFC. And he taught me some boxing. He got a Muay Thai guy to teach me some kickboxing and a jiu-jitsu black belt to teach me jiu-jitsu. But his version of teaching me how to fight was more wanting me to experience getting hurt. So when the jiu-jitsu guy came, this is all, I made a theme song for my book. Like, this may not be the best book in the world you got, but it has the best theme song of any book ever. And the theme song has some video of this. But so the jiu-jitsu guy shows up, and Randy immediately says to me, "Dude, you gotta get choked out. Choke him out." And I was like, "What? No, I don't. What do you mean? That's not." He's like, "You gotta know what it feels like to get choked out." So next thing I know, this guy takes his shirt off and he puts his, puts my neck in the crook of his arm, and he starts.
How long did you last?
Well, I don't think this black belt had ever tried to choke out a total pussy before, so he didn't know that my instinct, I knew I couldn't get his arm off. He's a huge man. So my instinct was to help and to try and fall asleep, which I think is reasonable. And apparently I'm a better actor than my drama teacher in high school would have thought, and he thought I fell asleep. So the next thing I know, Dana White's looking down at me. He's like, "Dude, did you dream?" I was like, "That's a lot to ask for those 6 seconds." Like, no. He's like, "It's crazy. You dream. Do it again." And so... he did it again.
And that time it actually worked?
No, I also convinced him I was falling asleep. So they wanted to do it a third time, but I couldn't. My throat was so messed up for the next week. That night I felt like Don Draper's dad because I couldn't swallow. I was spitting out my spit. I couldn't eat. My wife and child had come to Vegas, and I couldn't talk. I was just so, I was black and blue everywhere and just so tired, just exhausted. I just fell asleep with my clothes on. And I got she made me get a bath with bath salts, but I was just like, I seemed like I was being a dick, but I really wasn't. I was just like, I was just gone. And I think I don't know. I knew how some men come home and are just, after a day in the mines or whatever, just horrible people from that.
Do you think that the UFC fighting is so brutal because no men fight anymore, in the streets, in bars, to settle differences?
Well, you can't fight anymore. My dad grew up in the Bronx, and my dad, I'm a total wimp. I grew up, all my friends were girls, and I only listened to show tunes until, fifth or sixth grade. I had a glass animal collection.
Uh-huh.
I owned an Easy Bake oven. Which was awesome, because you got to make cakes in your room. I don't know why people are laughing. Someone just sent me an Easy Bake oven that says man-made on it, and it has those spikes and stuff. I can't wait to use that, my son. But, my dad is totally different than me. He's a little aggro and psycho. And the more I did stuff for this book, the more I learned that my dad really is crazy. From talking to my grandmother, I knew he had punched his sergeant right after basic training when he was in gunnery. But I didn't really know it until I did 3 days of basic training. They let me go with the troop in Fort Knox, and after being so scared of my fake sergeant, I mean real sergeant, but my fake experience for 3 days, I can't imagine what a psycho you'd have to be to punch your sergeant. I mean, it would be like being at the May Day parade in the Soviet Union and punching Joseph Stalin. It's just this guy is in complete control of you. So and my dad used to get in fights all the time, but back, I don't know if this would have stopped him, but now there's a really, not that there weren't guns back then, but I'm basing a lot of my knowledge on fighting on West Side Story.
Yeah.
So I don't know how accurate this is. But it seemed like he has some wounds from knives, but it seems like people didn't just whip out guns. Now I think people are a little, it's kind of like when people got nuclear weapons, there was less war. I think there's less bar, I don't know, are there less bar fights here? Could a bar fight break out tonight here?
Maybe not here.
Not here, okay. But somewhere in San Francisco tonight? Sweet. Let's go there after this.
So you don't think it's because we're a less aggressive culture, it's just that we have concealed carry laws that allow people to be armed, and it's just the immediate threat of death kind of looms over all fights that would normally have been handled with fisticuffs.
I think that's part of it, but I think we are a slightly less aggressive culture.
Have you ever
I think we're
been,
a less violent culture.
Have you ever
we
been
are.
In a situation where you should have fought
all
and
the time?
Didn't?
Yeah, recently, when I was writing this book, there was this awful incident. For a white guy, where my wife was driving up our little cul-de-sac in her Prius with my son in the back, and there's a guy in an SUV, and it's a weird turn on our street, and they almost hit each other, and he gave her the finger, And she got out of the car to ask him what he meant, even though I'm pretty sure she knew it meant fuck you. Yeah. And he got right in her face and is super aggressive and was, she thought, going to punch her. And she's manlier than me. She cries less than I do. So she came home and she was crying, so I knew something was wrong. And she told me the story and how freaked out she was. And I held her and told her to never get in a road rage incident in Los Angeles, which is not what a woman wants to hear.
Yeah.
After getting in a bad
Maybe.
Situation, she wants you to say, I'm going to go beat him up.
Yeah.
Which I only learned because I went straight to a meeting about a sitcom I was pitching with these producers. And once I told the story to the producers, I was no longer pitching a sitcom. I was now getting lectured about how I had to go over there and deal with him. And one of these producers kept a collapsible metal baton in his car. And he watches videos about how to hit people with collapsible metal batons.
Did he show you?
He was just telling me about it. But it was supposed to inspire me, but it just got me thinking, like, if a sitcom producer has a collapsible metal baton, what does a guy who threatens women in Priuses have in his house? So I never went over there.
Two batons.
At least two batons. So I never went over there, and I really regretted it. And it turned out, we found out later, that he was renting out part of someone's house, and he had been in jail for rape for a while. And I think a normal guy would have thought, well, I really should have gone over there then to protect my wife. But instead, I just thought, like, if that guy's been in jail for rape, like, I'm not going to talk sense into him. Like, he's had the world's been trying to teach him for a while.
So how soon did you guys move?
Well, he moved, luckily. I make it sound like we live in a really badass neighborhood.
Well, it's the power of the internet to let you know exactly what everyone did around you. To sort of help
it really
to
live, is.
Kind of to live in fear.
Yeah, and having a lawyer neighbors. Yeah.
So you're not a fighter.
No.
But you might be a man who can make some money. And I want to talk to you about another section of your book that I love.
You may not know this. I'm a journalist.
I know, but, okay. But for a hot minute, you played a day trader.
Yes.
And I want to talk to you about meeting this kind of wunderkind day trader in Chicago who gave you what is essentially the biggest single gift you've ever been given for a day.
Is anyone here? Does anyone here day trade on a regular basis? Good. Then we can tell you what it's like. Yeah, there's this incredibly nice guy in Chicago who offered to give me $100,000 for the day to day trade.
One day, $100,000 to spend however you want.
No, I had a day trade with it. I couldn't, like, buy a Ferrari. Actually, Ferraris are much more expensive. I couldn't buy whatever car I would buy.
So what happened?
It was really interesting. I didn't really understand what day trading was. I thought you researched a company and found out, like, who the CEO was and how much stuff they sold to China or vice versa. No. These guys are buying and selling in minutes companies they know nothing about other than someone else, other than how the price is fluctuating. It's really just numbers going up and down and them trying to trick other people into, it's poker. And in fact, the guy that gave me the $100,000 had made some enormous sum in his 3 years at USC, like $50,000 or something, playing online poker.
Wait, so how did you find this guy? Did you just, like, put it on Craigslist? Like,
pretty much, because I'd been looking for someone to do this. This was the second hardest thing to arrange in the book. The easiest was getting the military to let me do boot camp. This was the second hardest, and the very hardest was getting a dog fostering agency to let me foster a dog for 2 weeks. Dogs that were going to be killed.
It's the hardest thing to do
impossible.
In Los Angeles. It's
impossible. Those women have all been damaged by men, and it's as soon as they see you, they're going to get revenge. Like, that's why they love animals so much, because they hate men.
My wife and I did this also, yeah. It was impossible. It cost so much money to save the life of...
They inspect your house, right?
They come over to your house. I had to sign a contract saying that I would use a particular kind of ethical leash. And feed it's a leash that basically is a hug.
Yes, it goes around the middle. Yes,
and then feed a very high grade dog food.
I had to cook for my dog.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I had to make it food that was not dog food. It was human food.
What do you mean?
It was like
you had to actually
rice and meat and like carrots, sweet potatoes. The sweet potatoes were canned, but everything else was very fresh.
So basically, if your dog wanted to. Or let you could have dinner from your dog's leavings.
It was so funny because I'm afraid of dogs and I'm freaked out by dogs. And so, like, as soon as I would make this food, which was just a rice dish, I was like, I can't eat that. That is dog food. But it was better than what I was eating. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that was the hardest. Those women are, yeah, if you ever want to have, like, cheap, meaningless sex with a hot chick, I speak to all of you. Instead of, like, hitting on a stripper, I would recommend going to a bar, looking for a super hot chick, and just saying, so pretending you, like, met her at a dog adoption fundraiser. And even if she didn't, she'll just think you're an awesome dude anyway.
So you say, are you that girl from the dog adoption center?
Yeah, exactly.
And she says, I want to have sex with you.
No, she'll start talking to you about dogs.
Oh.
You'll have to have sex with a dog in the room. I don't know if that's going to hold you back.
And it's probably not just one dog, right?
I would think not.
Like a dog person doesn't have a single dog.
That's a good point. Yeah, because yes, the woman who...
It's going to be dogs.
My dogs. I couldn't get one officially. I got one from the woman who cuts my hair. What do you call the person that cuts your hair?
My barber.
Oh, so yeah, because you do GQ stuff. So
he's a guy. He's a guy, and there's a swirly little thing.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I love the swirly.
That means he can do medicine as well.
He has scissors, and he has a comb. And he has like four kinds of products.
They're
not really products. They're like it's like gel, a thing that makes my hair look like it's wet.
Your hair looks great.
Thank you. I know. And it's simple. It's $20.
Does he have like a copy of We or Swank or something around?
Like 1950s vintage porn magazines.
Yeah.
No, but he kind of talks like that. Yeah. So. I want to.
So this woman, I'm sorry, she had like, dogs are coming in and out of her house at all times. She has like seven dogs, so I got one of hers illegally.
And you don't have a dog now?
No, 2 weeks was enough. But there's a woman who has them now and living down the street. She's taking very care of them. It's a happy ending to the story.
Okay, so.
She has cancer, but otherwise it's a happy ending. It's a happy ending for the dog.
So Joel, you describe yourself as a pussy. And in the book, there's a great moment happens where you're actually talking to a fireman who is essentially like he's a hero.
Totally.
And you sort of pitch the idea of what this book is, to which he replies, not to dismiss your premise entirely, but none of the skills you plan on doing define becoming a man. A man is kind, courageous, protects women, is humble, bold, moral, seeks truth, loves children, and fights for what's right. To which you respond, he actually wrote that without one of those winking emoticon things. Which is to say, you don't buy that at all.
I believe that Buzz Smith, Captain Buzz Smith, believes that. No, I think, look, there's a premise to this book, which is somewhat offensive, which is that men and women are greatly different and should have different skills, which is not how I was brought up to believe. I grew up, I can sing any song right now from Free to Be You and Me if you want me to. My mom's a hardcore feminist. I'm a feminist. So this is not something that came naturally to me. Once I had a kid, I realized that genetically, the whole thing we were fed in the 70s about gender being a social construct was, I don't know how my mom stuck to that after having a boy and a girl. Like, we're so radically different. And so my premise is that the things I do in this book are skills that everyone should have, and everyone would get kudos from society for, a man or woman. But when a woman has it, people just think she's super awesome. And when a man doesn't have it, he's judged harshly. So they're kind of skills men have to have, at least. It's a very specific American kind of masculinity I'm talking about. It's a very... American masculinity all comes from, like, the Scotch-Irish... very Southern, Sir Walter Raleigh, Hatfields and McCoys. It's very emotive. It's very revenge and honor-based. It's not what you get in England. It's not what you get in the Northeast. It's not what my Jewish culture really comes from.
Yeah.
But it really has dominated American masculinity.
As a reminder to our audience, you guys tonight, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club. I'm going to start over for that.
That was
because
weak.
That was weak.
Yeah.
As a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's InForum, Connect Your Intellect. And tonight we're hosting Joel Stein. I'm going to open up for questions now about masculinity, manhood, or anything else you want to know about Joel, his family, his body, anything.
Or Micah, right? Can we ask you questions?
You can ask me questions, but I will just I'll funnel them right to you.
Seriously?
Oh, yeah. Right. This is your night. Yes, and I have a microphone. Does anyone? Okay. Yeah, a question over here.
Thanks, Joel. Living in L.A., do you find that being in a city makes it easier or harder for you to kind of partake in these manly activities?
Yeah, well, living in a city lets you escape a lot of things that I couldn't escape if I were, in the reddest part of a red state. You know, those people grew up knowing how to hunt and camp and all the things that I've never had to do because I grew up in very, very blue areas. So, yeah, I think you're inherently a little more self-reliant and a little more manly, regardless of gender, if you come from a rural background, at least the way we're defining it.
Anyone else? I want to... Yes.
Hello there. I had a question. Some of my pals and I, we actually have a men's book club. And is it true that if we read your book, that you will actually Skype with us?
Yeah, I've done it like 3 or 4 times now. Skype, never do a men's book club. I didn't know men shouldn't have book clubs, to be honest.
That's what I thought, but...
Women, I tried to have a book club once. Me and my friend Bob, we got a bunch of guys together, and we're going to read like some Dostoevsky. And we got together, and Bob's the only one who have read it, and that ended the book club. Yeah, no, women have book clubs, and they don't read the book either, but they just drink wine and, like, complain about their husbands.
Yeah.
So if you're going to do that, that's great. Otherwise, it's not a real book club. So, yeah, I've Skyped in to a couple book clubs, and they're all drinking wine, and I get to be part of it. I don't think they've read my book, but it makes me feel very important. I tell my son not to come in because I'm Skyping with the book club. It's great.
A question here.
Joel, your 3 favorite manly movies.
You know, I don't watch. That's part of the problem. I love, like, romantic comedies, and I think I've seen... I don't watch action movies ever. When I was reading this Clint Eastwood profile, I was like, I'm not sure I've seen this Clint Eastwood movie, a whole one. What are your 3 favorite manly movies? I've learned that people who ask questions always have the answer in their head.
Well, thank you for asking.
No problem.
Lawrence of Arabia.
I've seen that.
Oh, good. So
I guess that's manly in a British, you know, drink tea while the bombs are falling, stiff upper lip kind of way.
The Great Escape.
Oh, okay.
And perhaps Bullet, local movie with Steve McQueen.
Steve McQueen,
are you familiar with him?
Yeah, I watched Bullet once.
Did you?
Yeah.
Yes. He's a little older, more towards my generation.
Those are manly movies.
Yeah, so have you seen The Great Escape?
I've never seen The Great Escape.
Perhaps on the plane on the way home.
Really? Thank you. Any other film recommendations from the crowd? I can use them.
So, that actually dovetails nicely. Talking about Lawrence of Arabia with other things
that
I want to ask you about. So, you're not just a writer of manly things. You're also a journalist.
Yeah, mostly not manly things.
Yeah. And you started your career in the most manly of places, which is at Martha Stewart Living.
She was my first employer, yeah.
What was it like having Martha Stewart as a boss?
I had a little crush on Martha Stewart as a boss. She was a tough boss. I don't think all my bosses since then seem so easy. I was a bad fit on top of it. Like, I shouldn't have been. I was straight out of college, drove across country. I went to Stanford, drove back to New Jersey. I had a meeting with her at a restaurant called Sole Luna in Westport. So out of my element. She asked me if I wanted San Pellegrino, and I was like, I don't know what that is. And she laughed about that for 15 minutes, and then showed me pictures of her climbing Kilimanjaro and told me that she wanted her show to be like Letterman. So I left there bewildered and tried to write horrible jokes for her that she never used, and I wasn't the best Martha Stewart employee. I know how to force bulbs now, though.
But then this actually got you a job at Time Magazine.
I don't think that's true.
No.
Yeah, no.
It wasn't your ability to plant bulbs.
You know, someone I knew at Martha Stewart on the production side got me a job at a new magazine called Time Out New York, which led to my job at Time. So, yeah, Martha Stewart got me my job at Time.
And if there's any magazine sort of in the world that seems to perpetuate the idea of the great man kind of theory of history,
it's Martha Stewart.
It is Martha Stewart.
It is, because she's on the cover of every one of those.
Oh, yeah.
That and O. Yeah. She is the great man.
Her seasonal arrangements, they really say something about the power of man.
No,
I'm talking about Time Magazine, of course.
Oh, that's true.
So Time Magazine has the man of the year, except for in 1988 when they had the Earth as
the
man of the year. And then 2006 was that awful You,
the mirror?
You.
Yeah.
But beyond that, you write for a magazine that seems to really believe in the power of individuals and the power of men.
Yeah.
Do you believe in the power of men?
We call it Person of the Year now.
Person of the Year?
I believe in the power of people very much. Yeah, I think there are definitely constantly multiple paths the world can go, and individuals make an enormous difference in deciding where we go. I grew up, like I said, in the 70s, so we were taught history as kind of an unstoppable march led by technology and economic factors. You know, I grew up in the time when we were taught the Civil War was due to a manufacturing disagreement. We really were, it was a trade disagreement. And turns out that's totally not true, and I don't know why I know why, but I believe that for a long time because I was taught that, and there's something reassuring about that theory. But I don't. I believe the world is chaos, that it could be dinosaurs. Like, if you go to another planet, I'm sure they're just giant monsters. Like, I'm sure it's all, anything can happen. And I do think people make a great, I will see Spielberg's Lincoln, if that's your question.
Well, there's one thing that I think that kind of really can reorient someone's notion of who they are as a man, and that's becoming a father. I don't speak from experience. All of my children are still inside my body.
Wow.
But you have a son, and that seems to be part of the impetus for why you wrote the book. How would you characterize yourself before and after having a kid?
I actually have probably more humility about I still have the great man theory. I don't think you can shape a person that much. This is what my dad, what Randy Couture tells me in the book. Because when I had, basically the reason I wrote this book is because I thought I didn't care what the gender of my child was. Then I went to the sonogram, and our very cool OBGYN pointed to our son's penis, which she's a really smart woman, but she was very obsessed with his penis, and she kept writing. You get this like film strip of pictures now from the sonogram, and she kept writing "wow" and pointing to his penis, and she drew a penis and testicles, and
like a telestrator, like as you would on the NFL.
Yes, and then she told me if he doesn't do well in school, he can always work in the valley, and this was all floating through my brain, and all I'm sitting there thinking is like, oh my God, this penis is going to want to go camping. And this penis is going to want to, learn to hunt. And this penis is going to want to play baseball. And this penis is going to get in a fight. And, I am not capable of helping with any of this stuff. And I kind of freaked out. And that's when I decided to, learn as much of the stuff as I could, before he gets old enough where he's going to need that stuff.
What does your wife think about you writing about your son and his penis? Do you guys have, an arrangement or an agreement that they're fair game, or do you have to negotiate every one of because both Laszlo and Cassandra they figure really prominently in the book.
Yeah, well, my wife is particularly easy because I've been writing a column since sophomore year of college about myself because I don't really care about anything else, and I no one was covering that beat, which seemed like a real shame. So I've dated other people while I was writing this column. I have parents who I've written about, friends, and everyone is so different about, even when I do celebrity profiles, people are so different about how they feel about being portrayed in print that I treat everyone differently. And I run everything about her by her, but she, I'd say 1% of the time, has a complaint. She's very, in person, she's much more liable to say something really offensive than I am. She really enjoys that. And she has a horrible, horrible delivery. She has a very severe, that sounds horrible. She's a very Europe, Eastern European looking face. I'm not making her sound pretty. She's beautiful. If I can, if you leave here thinking one thing, it's that my wife is really pretty, and I said Aww. That, and nice and smart, and I can proceed. She has a severe face, so she makes jokes and no one enjoys them. She had to get, probably shouldn't be, don't tell her so this, she had to get a colonoscopy. And
let's keep it going.
Yeah. She awoke, they knock you out for that. She awoke, and they ask you if you're all right, and the first thing she said to them was, I guess I won't be having anal sex tonight.
Awesome.
Which is a tremendous joke, but she has hard livery, and they looked at her like kind of freakish.
That's a zinger.
Yeah. So she's willing to go to places I wouldn't go to, but she doesn't get away with it in life, and she thinks it's sexism, and she's very angry about this. So
clearly nothing is really off limits. From your life, or do you find
it's
that
funny? What people find off limits is stuff that you, like, I did this column or an article on tax day for Business Week, in which I had my taxes done by like a super high end accountant, my accountant, H&R Block, and like the free online one. And I compared the results, and in order to do that, I had to talk about how much I made that year, and that's. In our society, what freaks people out.
Yeah.
I've talked about how many women I've slept with, but none of that freaks people out. And then, like, your finances.
So you publish your net worth on the...
I think it was my net worth. It was, like, my 2001 returns. Yeah.
That's fantastic. Does it feel therapeutic to write about yourself? Is it something that actually helps you process the things that are going on in your life in sort of an important way? Or is it that you really just don't have any better material?
You know, it's a couple things. It's one, it does help me process things. Two, I think this is most people, but it's certainly for me, I can learn things best if I do them. Like Friday, I'm writing about this new Cirque du Soleil movie, so I went out to Vegas, and Cirque du Soleil let me do some of their stuff. Or I wrote a profile of the CEO of Chipotle. So I was kind of not getting some stuff he was saying, so they let me work in Chipotle for half a day. And I just find that really helps me learn things. So for the column, I often do like a really, and for this book, super shallow poor man's George Plimpton, and I go experience something. And it's also true. Like, I don't have that much material. Like, I read the New York Times columnists who are so good, so much better than me, but 90% of the time they wrote about what the president did that day or that week. And there's just a thousand, and I couldn't distinguish myself that way. I'm not as smart as them. I don't have as many opinions as them on this. So the idea of like just writing about what the president did just seemed like I would never get anywhere and it would be boring.
But you get to go to the DNC and the RNC and meet these people all
the
time.
But I have to find weird things there. They don't just send me there to go talk to delegates. I have to go, like, at the RNC, you guys know what the Log Cabin Republicans are. They're the gay Republicans. But there's a splinter group now of gay Republicans who are much more Tea Party and much more gay. And they were throwing a party at a gay bar, like a real, like, disco, guys in tight shirts dancing on tables and stuff, go-go dancers. And so I was like, I got to go over there. And there's a schism in the gay Republicans. I need to write about that. So I got to go, Grover Norquist came. Like, there's all these
awesome
gay rights supporters in the Republican Party you wouldn't know about. So I found it all really interesting. So I wrote about that. But, like, people are, I think my employer is sending me to the conventions knowing I have to find something weird.
Yeah. Actually, I want to ask about homosexuality.
Please.
The philosopher Louis C.K. recently did a bit that I really loved, and he basically said that the only population that really cares about what everyone else thinks about their sexuality are straight men.
Yes.
You don't have gay men worrying about, do I look straight?
Right, right, right.
And the same is true for women.
Right.
We, as a population, and also as two men who, I would say 15% of people think that I'm gay.
That
number skyrockets when I'm home in Oklahoma. Just skyrockets.
Sure.
Oh, yeah. Like 60% of people.
Yeah.
And
you're being...
And you expend a lot of energy if your dad is someone who did subscribe to Martha Stewart magazine. Because he read it and loved it, like policing those borders between your gender identity and your sexuality.
Yeah, it's a lot of wasted energy, isn't it? It's
it is.
Yeah, it becomes, it's funny when people...
See, it's so hard being a straight man.
It is amazing. All those Judd Apatow movies are spent, like, pretending each other. It's going to seem so, I love those movies, but they're going to seem so dated in 20 years that they spent so much energy, like, being okay with being gay, but calling each other gay. Like, it's so much of your identity is wrapped up in people not thinking that it's,
why
it's
are,
so threatening. Yeah.
Why are straight men obsessed with being straight?
Why is it so threatening to be thought of as gay? I'll just rephrase your question instead of answering it.
Yeah. Should we ask the audience?
I would love. Yeah, I thought I had the answer for this, but does someone here know? Why we then?
What is the actual answer to this question? Do we know why? Why straight men
worry
care
so much about this?
So much about this. Tonight is a safe space for straight men, and in particular straight white men everywhere. It's when we're going to process a lot of our insecurities and anxieties, and this is our time. So
there's a practical aspect, right? Because we spend an enormous percentage of our time trying to get laid. So if people think we're gay, that's going to definitely inhibit our main activity.
Oh.
So that's a practical part, but the bigger part is the identity part. It's really worrying about men thinking we're gay, not women. So, yeah, I think it's very tribal. Because when I had my head shaved I did something with the Marines and I did something with the Army, as soon as the hair came off, I got really harsh and judgmental about men with hair. I immediately thought it looked ornamental and foppish and like why are you wearing jewelry on your head? Like, it was very, very tribal. Like, and I think that's what it comes down to. Like, you're either in our group or not in our group, and you want to delineate these groups. And it's not, I mean, it's what leads to wars. It's not a good feeling, but I think it's in there somewhere.
Yeah. Is this a second whisper?
What?
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
Is this a second sparkling water?
Well done.
Oh, my God.
Well done.
Slow me down.
So there's another aspect of manhood that is sort of, it's omnipresent, but it's utterly, you don't acknowledge it at all in your book, which is comedy and humor itself.
Yeah.
If anything, like, that's your muscles, that's your ability to save people from fire, that's your ability to defend your country. It's just contained within your own person, and it's, like, way weaker, but it's still manhood.
It is, because guys who have no other skills or anything appealing about them tend to develop a sense of humor. And so what we're really doing is anyone you know who's funny is spending a good part of their brain not listening to you, or actually listening really hard to you, but not listening to, like, the point you're making, just looking for a moment when they can jump in and make a joke. So part of my brain is always doing that, and it's so dickish and it's horrible. But yeah, it's the only way I could think to get attention. And you're right. When you jump in and you make a joke, you're kind of establishing something in the pecking order.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to note that, like, as society progresses, you often hear older men say that women aren't funny. And I think they're reacting to an older paradigm where that wasn't acceptable for women, where that wasn't valued in women, where women didn't have to establish themselves so much in the pecking order. So women were funny, but they weren't as aggressive about it. And that's obviously almost entirely not true anymore. And I think it's taking people a while to get used to that.
Will we as men become less funny as women begin to...
No. No, I just wrote a whole column about this. I have the opposite problem. I think everyone is trying to be funny now, and it's weird. Like, everyone is required to be funny on Twitter, on Facebook, in presidential debates. Like, everyone has to have what zingers and one-liners, and, like, Conan O'Brien just started doing this very Charlie Rose, like, interview online, where he sat down with Edmund Morris and talked about Theodore Roosevelt for 40 minutes. And it was because he's sick of, like, having people on for 6 minutes and having to be funny. And yeah, so I think it's the opposite. Everyone is part of this race. We're all, especially on Twitter, like, everyone is sitting in the back of the class waiting to make a joke and make fun of whatever just happened. And I don't know if that's so great. And it's women as much as men.
Well, it's not just comedy. It's performance. We're being asked to perform all the time.
Right.
In
and
everything.
The easiest way to perform in a short attention span culture is a joke. Like, that's the most, you know, that's the vehicle for information that's going to travel fastest, is a joke, other than nudity.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's hard on Twitter.
Although, it can be done.
It can be done. Not by us.
No, definitely not. I'm going to break now. We have about 15 minutes left for any questions from the audience. We have one right here.
Hello. Hi, Paul. Is this working? Oh, hello. So you say a lot of pretty harsh things, seemingly without any remorse at all. So I just wanted to ask about, I know you've written a lot of controversial columns.
Oh, my God, I'm in San Francisco.
About,
I forgot.
Yeah.
You say things
a time that you've actually been sorry for something you said, or that you actually, like, had to apologize for something you said.
Oh, yeah.
Could be, like, a column or live on air, anything like that, right now, that you just said that you want to
take
back.
Yeah. I'm starting to feel like the public apology is bullshit. That people should stop publicly apologizing for things. Because they're apologizing for getting caught saying something. They are apologizing for hurting people's feelings, but they're not really apologizing. It's like, and also we hold everything to the same standard. When Gilbert Gottfried made that joke about, Gilbert Gottfried had been the Aflac duck, and he made a joke on Twitter about the tsunami right after the tsunami, and everyone went crazy. He lost his Aflac duckness. And, people were commentating that Gilbert Gottfried made a comment that was insensitive. He wasn't making a comment, he was making a joke. And, like, everything everyone says, we are so excited to be offended by. And there's different contexts for different statements. And a comedian making a joke, I think, not that you get a pass for making a joke, but it's a different context than Todd Akin on TV being interviewed. I think we need to start to delineate that a little bit better. So, yeah, there are things I really wish I hadn't written, I wish I hadn't said, mostly because I think I didn't say them well, not because I thought that my opinion was wrong. I mean, someone walked up to me not too long ago, or actually emailed me and said, I agree with all of your columns, to which I wrote, I don't agree with all of my columns. Like, that's impossible. Like, I find that a lot of what I say is me trying to figure out stuff or me trying to start a conversation. And I learn I'm wrong a lot, and people inform me of that. So there are things I wrote that I disagree with. There are things I wrote that I didn't state very well and offended people. I wrote a column called I Don't Support the Troops, where I found out America supports the troops. I wrote a column about my racism against Indians. Did not go over well with anyone. And I can go on and on, sadly. But yeah, there's a lot of things I've written which offended people, and I think I don't regret what I meant to say, but I regret what I said.
So you talked about Gilbert Gottfried being, you know, making a comment on Twitter and that kind of backfiring on him. Do you use kind of that instantaneous media versus time? I mean, how do you balance the two, and do you use them differently?
Can you flip the mic on?
Yeah.
Is that all right?
The question was, do I treat Twitter differently than treat Time Magazine?
Yeah, and how do you balance kind of the immediate, you know, message you want to send versus the more structured?
Well, Twitter doesn't pay me, so I'm much less interested in what I do there. Twitter has a lot of downside. I mean, I run things I'm going to say stupidly by my wife. I wish there was someone else I could run it by as a check of offensiveness. But yeah, people, there's been more careers ruined than made on Twitter, I think. So yeah, Twitter is just a place for a joke that you can't deposit anywhere else or a thought you can't deposit yet. Although I've taken jokes I've made on Twitter and used them in columns later a couple times.
Is that plagiarizing yourself? Didn't Fareed Zakaria like go down for that?
No. Fareed went down for something. He plagiarized someone else. But Jonah Lehrer went down for plagiarizing himself. Yeah, I never use stuff I used in print again because I knew that rule because I'd been taught that rule. But I wasn't sure if Twitter seemed like a place you were experimenting, and it wasn't really in print yet because it feel like it disappears. But you're right. Maybe I shouldn't be doing that either.
I'm not a lawyer. A question here.
Joel.
I can name your three favorite movies.
Okay.
Sorry.
Karnak, have you ever done stand-up comedy?
No, stand-up comedy is very hard. That's like being Homer without a lute. There's a stand-up comic behind me, apparently. She's just, oh no, you've dated stand-up comics. No. It is, right? Have you considered it, or what? You seem so afraid, personally afraid. Did you have a bad experience somewhere? And you just feel bad for them from a distance. I do too. Yeah, it just seems like every other entertainment meeting we have has like a lot of whistles and bells and lights to help entertain people, and you're just out there alone. And if you succeed, you get to go to like Giggles at the Mall of America in Minneapolis, and like, oh, yeah, I don't know.
Open for Gallagher.
Yeah, I hate speaking in public as it is. I couldn't imagine.
Have you ever been camping? And if so, did you make s'mores?
Well, I've made s'mores many times. You don't have to camp to make s'mores, thank God, in this country, while it's still America. I went camping for the book. I'd never been camping before. So the first chapter of the book is me asking the Boy Scouts if I can earn my first badge. And so I went with a bunch of 11-year-olds and was a Boy Scout and went on my first camping experience. And I'm sure you all camp because you're in San Francisco and you have nice tents, but I do not understand tents and the tent business, because from my experience, sleeping in a tent is exactly as the same as sleeping outside not in a tent. I think the tent industry has really pulled one over on people.
Yes. A question over here.
I was wondering, college can be a pretty defining period in one's life, particularly for manhood, I would say, coming from under your parents' wings. I, like you, went to Stanford undergrad and can be a pretty PC kind of country club place. And I was just wondering how that kind of factored into your development in your teenage years.
Did Stanford make you less manly or just didn't teach you anything?
I don't know. I don't know that it taught me much of anything, yeah. But I don't know. What's your take on it?
Well, it was my first experience with the West. And so there was a couple, like, when you got there that first week, they made you square dance. And then there was, like, did you go on that week, your senior year, where they tried to introduce you to the Stanford, like, Sierra thing? Yeah, and there was, I felt like we were doing manly stuff out in the woods. So for a guy like me, it was pretty good. It seemed like it would beat going to Yale as far as manliness. Not much, but a little bit. Yeah, college doesn't really stress outdoorsing that much. Those kids that go on the outdoor bound trips.
Right, it's exactly 1 week, and you sign all kinds of waivers, and then like half the kids go home immediately from blisters or like sleep apnea, or they just discover they have some skin disorder.
Did you do this?
I did.
Did you do outdoor bound?
I did the freshman orientation trip, and it was miserable.
Wait, what school is this again?
I went to Harvard.
And
it was boo. And it was the most neurotic people in the entire world, trapped in confined areas, and it was raining the entire time. And what you do is you sort of sit in the tent and stare at each other, wondering who will one day be more successful.
Wait, so you're saying part of Harvard orientation is camping?
Yes. Yes.
Is this because of Theodore Roosevelt?
Every school has this.
Absolutely not. Dartmouth has it, too, I think. But no. Do most people have that experience?
Yeah. It's a formative thing.
You all went to Harvard.
Yeah.
It's a Commonwealth Club. That explains it.
Yeah. It's a classy crowd.
Wow. Yeah, so your question has been answered for both of us. Yes, Stanford was particularly wussy. Square dancing is as far as we got. Damn them.
A question over here in the back. Oh, we have one over here.
Hey, Joel. Hey. Thanks for the talk. I was just wondering your thoughts on like Viagra-type medications and perpetuating sexuality into infinity and the role of manliness and manhood in that, or lack thereof.
Do you perhaps have a story you want to share?
advertising in the media and, you know, how that plays upon the aging male and what that means for masculinity.
I am about 15 feet from you, but I'm pretty sure your heart is a rock right now. So I think that was a weird choice to make for this speech. But whatever works. yeah, I'm old, but I'm not quite old enough where I should have taken Viagra for the book, but I have never I'm bragging at this point. I've never taken Viagra. So it lets men be virile and younger for a lot longer, right? That's got to all this stuff. It's like I think about like the fact that like if I went back 300 years and I told people I was 41, they'd be like, "That's impossible. You have all your teeth." Like we keep youthing up our culture, and in every way, both physically and living at home longer. And yeah, it's all infantilizing. We all go see superhero movies when we're 40. Like I'm expected to know the difference between the Thor and the Hulk. And like, yeah, I think that we're stretching out everything. I don't know if that's manly. There's something manly about being an old guy who can't get it up, isn't there? Cranky old man who just doesn't care anymore.
Like you still want to get it up. It's the desire. Have you ever lied about your age?
I have not, but...
I've met more and more men in Los Angeles who lie about their age.
Younger?
Yeah.
Because these are actors?
Yes.
Oh, okay, well, there you go.
Another question. Back here, I think, first, and then you, sir.
Sure. Just by reading the cover leaf of your book, it seems like this was sort of a quest... built on your feeling a bit insecure about being a father and that you were lacking some skills, and therefore you must have been a bit unsatisfied with your level of manliness. And I'm just wondering, you did sort of a survey of manliness. Of that survey, who did you find who was sort of most happy and or satisfied with their level of manliness or their state of manliosity?
You know, most of the guys I spoke to in this book thought my quest was weird and insane. Because it was just part of their lives. They were firemen or they were in the military. And they became sort of fascinated by me because we'd have these conversations that they couldn't relate to at all. Like, I'd sit down and they'd say, "Tell me about your hobbies." And I would not know how to answer that question. I was like, "I don't have a hobby. I don't know anyone who has a hobby. What do you call, is watching TV a hobby? Cooking?" And they would be like, "No, like, I fix, cars from the 50s and drag race and, like, fish for... big fish." And I, so I felt like there were lots of men who felt very secure in their masculinity who I met, none of whom I'm friends with.
So I haven't read the book, obviously, yet. But
did you read the flap? Like
I did.
That guy?
I did.
Okay, good.
I did. That's... So you did some pretty interesting things, very different things for you in your quest to better understand manliness or how are you going to raise your kid. I'm just curious if you got anything out of it that you think, yeah, I'm going to use that when the time comes.
Oh, yeah. This is hard for you to believe because you're meeting me for the first time, but I'm like 13% manlier than I was before I wrote the book. I keep coming back to this, but I fixed like four things around my house. I am now totally ready to take my son camping, as I actually went camping twice for the book. What else? Well, there's some things I really didn't enjoy that I won't be doing again, like hunting. I went turkey hunting. Has anyone here been turkey hunting? It's crazy. Have you been a lot?
Yeah.
Can you?
You sit under a tree and you wait for hours upon hours, and
then you hope to finally get a shot at something.
You're leaving out key parts of turkey hunting. You pretend to be what?
A bush.
No. Do you make turkey calls?
Yeah, but there's a lot of different ways to do it now.
Oh, really?
Science has kept up, and now there's a little box. All you have to do is move a piece of wood, and it makes a sound.
What is the sound you're trying to make, though?
Can't.
No, but the sound is a female turkey in heat, right?
Yes.
So you're trying to draw. You're trying as hard as you can. My guide, through his facial expressions, through his attitude, through his sounds he made, you're trying to be a female turkey that desperately wants to have sex with any male turkey you can find. And you draw that, and we saw a male turkey at some point when we were turkey hunting on the road. And I got in the car with shotgun and my friend Matt, who's actually married to the girl I had a crush on from kindergarten to fifth grade. He's much manlier. He chopped down logs in his backyard to build part of his log cabin. And he looked at me when I got out of the car with the shotgun. He's like, "What are you doing?" I said, "We're going to shoot that turkey." He's like, "You can't shoot that turkey in the middle of a field. That's not the game." He looked at me like I was like the most uncouth, psychopathic turkey killer in the world. And so what the game is, you make these noises, you pretend you're a hot, sexy turkey that just wants it from anyone. And when the turkey approaches you to about this distance, you blow his head off. And that's the game. I don't know if a turkey knows about this game, but that's like, that is the ethical, humane hunting way of killing a turkey.
But did you win the game? Did you actually kill a turkey?
We blew it because there was a part of the game involves if there's another female turkey with your male turkey, you have to get in a verbal argument with that turkey. Basically, like, get away from my man, you slut. And another turkey beat us at the game.
You, like, take your earrings out and pull her hair out?
Yeah, you, through calls, you do that. And then we had a fake Jake, which is the young male turkey. We had a fake one near us because part of what... By the way, if you eat turkey, I think it's wrong to eat meat even though I do it. But if you eat turkey, you should feel really good about it because turkeys are horrible people. And what they do is the male turkey spends, during mating season, spends the entire morning having sex with as many female turkeys as he can until, according to Matt, his pecker hurts. And if a young male turkey comes and tries to get part of the action, the older male turkey beats the crap out of the young turkey and makes him sit there and watch. So eat away.
How does the male turkey position the younger turkey to make sure that it's watching?
I did not get to that, but I think it's just intimidation.
That's fantastic. So in keeping with that, we have a few minutes left, and I wanna just get as much knowledge from you as possible.
I think you have.
In the form of advice.
Oh, sure.
On becoming a man. If you could distill your book.
Sure.
And sort of all of your meanderings, all of your thinking, all of your experiences into a few sort of choice lessons for us.
Right. That's what our society wants, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Society.
Like, let's just knock it down.
Right. My book is too complicated for our culture.
Too complicated. Distill it down. We have some flap readers over here.
Right.
He's not going to read the book. He wants to know the quick takeaways.
140 characters.
140 characters. No, but seriously, Joel, like if you are giving advice, which you sort of are to your son in this book, what do you tell him? Tell us that too.
Well, I've found through this book and through other things in my life that if I push myself to do things I am very uncomfortable with, I become a slightly different person. And even when I don't become a slightly different person, I am able to interact with and understand other people a lot better. Like, I used to be at the airport and see guys in military uniforms and not know how to react. Like, am I supposed to thank them? Or they just not want my wimpy face around theirs? Or am I supposed to give them my seat? Or is that treating them like, a handicapped person? Or, like, I didn't know the rules. And now when I see a military guy, I can at least talk about where they did basic training. The Army let me, I'm the only civilian who's ever fired a tank. So that's a good entree into conversation with these guys. So I find that by expanding what I do, even if I don't change or don't like it, I have an entree into the world that is really valuable. And even though I hate doing that stuff, like, I'm afraid of heights. I didn't want to be with the Cirque du Soleil on Friday. But I'm so glad I did it. And like, I'm less afraid of heights from doing some of these things. And I know circus people now. That's going to
be good people,
valuable.
And they're all French-Canadian, right? They're all sort of macabre, sad people from Quebec.
They're mostly like Eastern European Olympic gymnasts.
Oh. Okay.
Close.
Well, that blows my mind.
Cirque du Soleil does take place, is from Montreal or Quebec City or something.
So, Joel, to conclude, and we're time's up, man.
Do we win anything?
We have one more question, which is the sort of like the signature in forum question.
Oh, really?
Connect your intellect in forum.
Who came up with this question?
And the question is...
Is this Proust?
This is not Proust. Okay. This is better than Proust. And the question is this. What is your 60-second idea to change the world, Joel Stein?
That's ridiculous. first of all, I'm pretty impressed with the world. I couldn't have done this. So I'm always surprised that people are... treat people so nicely and there isn't chaos erupting in the streets at all time as I stall. I guess I wind up in this book with a very pro-British masculinity, and I believe strongly in repression, especially short-term repression, not never expressing what you feel, but just like not being that reactive, angry, honor-bound culture, and instead like not saying what you think when you're in a fight or when someone tells you something and giving yourself 5, 10 minutes, 2, 3 days to react. I think that's really valuable, and I think it allows you to do the more important thing, which is to see something from another person's perspective, which is really the key to most discussions. I have not fixed the world, have I?
You might have changed it. It wasn't fixed. It was just changed.
Oh, change?
Yeah.
Oh, just give him a Coke.
Nice.
Thanks.
Let's give Joel Stein a big round of applause.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to pick up the gavel again, and I'm going to say that now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.